You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Hey, our topic today is one that really fascinates me. I mean, it's really kind of a universal topic, even though we're using as an example a park in New Orleans. This is the concept of urban parks. With me is Bob Becker, who's the fairly recently retired CEO of New Orleans City Park. Did a great job during the time he was there. And his book called "What New Orleans City Park from Tragedy to Triumph." And it certainly faced a lot of tragedy and certainly faced a lot of triumph. And so it's a great name for it. If you're not familiar with City Park, it is a beautiful park in New Orleans. Was it 1,300 acres, Bob?
Yes, 1,300 acres, almost twice as large as Central Park.
Yeah. Which is something I always like to tell people, because people always say, we have a Central Park. But yeah, this is bigger than Central Park. I mean, you could put a couple of Central Parks inside City Park.
That's correct.
Yeah. And it's one of the most visited urban parks in the country. I saw a figure that said something like there was 750 other urban parks. I don't believe that. I mean, it says the 87th largest public park in the country. That can't be. I wouldn't think.
It's hard to tell. People make up these statistics all the time about how big is the park, how many people visit the park. Yeah. But we do know from taking surveys in the park that it is one of the most visited parks, urban parks in the country, and one of the largest urban parks in the country.
According to this, the 20 most visited urban public park, and my source is irrefutable. It's called Wikipedia, okay?
Right, absolutely.
But that's fairly prestigious. It's a very important piece of space. I want to talk a little bit about the philosophy of park. But first, let's begin with the tragedy. And over time, there's going to be tragedies. But the biggest one was Katrina. And the city park under your guidance, it was just starting to be at full bloom at that point. You all had done a master plan. Many elements of the master plan had been developed. It was just a beautiful, beautiful place. Then Katrina came. And tell us about your experience the first time you went to the park after Katrina.
Well, the storm hit on August 29th. There was a mandatory evacuation notice in the city. So I got my people out, and then I evacuated with my family. And it was several weeks before we were allowed back in. You had to get a permit to get back in because the National Guard was had the park closed off, particularly because they were concerned about the art that was in the art museum and protecting that. So the park was closed off. So it took a couple of weeks for us to get back in. And once we were able to manage to get a permit to get back in and saw, just how devastating the storm had been, I thought in my mind it would be 25 years before the park could recover. 80% of the park was flooded and still flooded by the time we got back in, because the Corps of Engineers had not yet pumped the city down. And as we made our way through various parts of the park, it was a dreadful, dreadful scene. All the buildings had been flooded and many were completely destroyed, and all the equipment had been flooded, and it was and were lost. And so when I think back and remember the devastation that was there, not only in the city but in the park, which is kind of in the center of the city, I really thought it would be 25 years before the park would be able to recover.
I remember, like everybody else, I was kind of going back and forth from out of town, and we had an office near Baton Rouge, and one of our colleagues had gone into New Orleans, and he was kind of talking about New Orleans. And then he said, knowing that I had really had a sentimental touch of City Park, he says, "Oh, Errol, we used to see City Park. It's awful." And when I finally got to New Orleans, and to this day, the word that pops in my mind every time I think about my first visit to City Park after Katrina is gray. It's like the whole park was, you know, all those luscious green and trees and vines, everything else. It's like the whole park was painted gray. It was just a dreary, deadly dull gray.
It was. And the other memory that I have was the silence. I mean, there was no birds. There was, you know, singing. There was no there was no sound because everything was dead in the park. All the grass had died. The plants were killed. The wildlife, you know, if they managed to get out and find higher ground, you know, they moved out. It was a pretty surreal experience to see that large an area in the middle of a major American city completely dead.
You know, the thing, I never realized the impact of what you just said, but I guess it was that same visit when I finally went to our block and I saw a neighbor and he came walking down the street. And of course, the block looked terrible. But and then he said, "Listen, what do you hear?" I said, "I don't hear anything." He says, "Well, that's it. There's nothing. There's no bird." That's the first time somebody talked about no birds and the concept of not having that. I mean there was no natural sound out there.
Yeah. The only real sound that I remember hearing was helicopter sound, you know, various helicopters around. And in fact, when we made our way into the park, into the front part of the park, we were by the botanical garden. There were three of us who had managed to get in. And we were standing by the botanical garden. And I heard this sound of this helicopter come from up over the art museum, and it came up over the art museum, and it kind of settled above us where we were standing in front of the botanical garden. And I thought, well, I'm going to be shot here by the National Guard, you know, for trying to break into a garden. this is what's going to happen to me. And then around the corner from the art museum comes the National Guard in a Jeep. And, you know, what are you doing here? And, you know, you got to get out and all that. So, well, we run this park. We're trying to assess the damage. And then the National Guard broke into the garden and took the chainsaws that we had in the garden. And they were using them for their own purposes.
They bought into the... So you're working there. I mean, they allowed you to do that.
They you know, they allowed us. I mean, it was once they realized we were not there to rob the art museum, you know, they didn't really care that much.
Yeah. The trees, how many trees did the park lose?
Well, we lost 1,000 immediately that were blown over or snapped in half as a result of the storm. And we lost another 1,000 within 6 months because of the saltwater, you know, intrusion as a result of the Corps not being able to pump the city completely dry. So, and I'm sure over the next 10 years or so, you know, we lost many, many more that finally succumbed, to being flooded.
Now, with City Park, among many things, is what perhaps most famous for is it's a amazing live oaks. It has the largest supply of live oaks in the country.
It does, and in that sense, we were extremely fortunate because most of the live oaks sit near the front of the park, near what is City Park Avenue, and that part of the park sustained very minimal flooding because it was on a ridge, a natural ridge that made it higher than the rest of the park. So, well, areas in the back of the park, including the golf courses, took 8 feet of water for several weeks. The areas right in the front part of the park, which had most of the big live oaks in them, did not really flood. And as a result, most of those were able to be saved.
Now, if people are totally familiar with, or if they're a little familiar with New Orleans, you mentioned City Park Avenue. That's an extension of the old Metairie Road or Bayou Metairie, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It runs right along an extension of a tributary of the Mississippi River, actually, right? It's right parallel to City Park Avenue. And as I said, it's higher. It's like the Gentilly Ridge or the Esplanade Ridge It runs along the Metairie Ridge there and is higher than the rest of the park.
Do you know what the science is? Why did so many live oaks accumulate at that one spot?
You know, I don't know. I know that, you know, way back, way back, you know, there were naturally growing oak trees on that higher ground that existed there. And then when the first people who took responsibility for the park, which City Park Improvement Association did, they planted a bunch of live oaks, and they planted them along that ridge because I believe they, you know, they knew they'd have a better chance of long-term survival on higher ground.
Yeah. But it's a long time for an oak to grow to, I mean, to be a mature adult. Huh?
Yeah. Takes hundreds of years for a tree to reach its full potential.
Yeah. What area of the park was the worst damaged?
Well, the area of the park that took the most water was in the back where the golf courses were and the golf clubhouse that took 8 feet of water. and then because of the grade of the land, the various aspects of the park took lesser water as you move towards the front of the park, towards City Park Avenue. But most of the buildings and most of the equipment were in the front part of the park. So the amusement park, Tad Gormley Stadium, you know, the administration building, quadruplex, yada, 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 those took heavy damage from not only the wind, but mainly the flooding aspect of it. So the back part of the park got the most water, but a lot of it was golf courses. So, you know, the golf courses were heavily damaged and mainly destroyed, and so they were expensive to redo. But the most real damage occurred in kind of the front of the park, right along where the Botanical Garden is. And, you know, that kind of was a line between the Botanical Garden and City Park Avenue. That was a higher ground from the Botanical Garden back towards the interstate. And, you know, on the other side of the interstate, that had the most damage.
Did you lose most of your employees?
We did. At the time, the park was almost totally self-sustaining in the sense that it got virtually no public operating money to operate. So when the storm hit, it cut off all the revenue to the park immediately, and we didn't have a whole lot of money in the bank. So we were unable to make the payroll for our, you know, for our employees. So I ended up laying off a couple hundred employees, full-time and part-time, almost immediately because we didn't have any money. And we could only afford to keep 13 employees on a payroll. And then a local foundation, the ASB Fund, came up and provided money to provide this for the salaries of 10 Botanical Garden employees. So total, we had 23 employees that we were able to keep on board for, you know, for the foreseeable future, which lasted, you know, a couple of years.
And that was from how many, down from how many?
Well, there were several hundred that we laid off. So, you know, we laid off about 90% of all the employees that we had.
What did this do to you? I mean, it's got to be terribly depressing to see the park ruin, to have to lay off all those employees. Did you feel like you were up for the job or I mean, were you ready to go headlong into it? Or?
You know, Errol, it's one of those situations where you kind of put one foot in front of the other. My house was north of the park and took 3 feet of water in my house. And so, you know, I would work in the day in the park with my 23 employees. And then at night I would go home to, you know, to my house as best I could and work on my house on the weekends. And it was, you know, it was sort of, you have to put one foot in front of the other. I mean, you know, what do you do? Just give up? And I mean, my wife and I talked about just doing just that. Well, maybe we should just move to Dallas and, you know, this is never going to recover. We don't have any money. We don't have any employees. Our house is flooded. You know, what do we do? But, you know, in the end, you know, the 23 people that we had, they needed to know there was a future. They needed to know that the park could come back and that there could be a plan for what was happening. And so that was, it was important for me to be here and to give them direction. And as you mentioned before, we had just finished a new master plan. So we had a plan for what to do, and that helped us raise money. And gradually over the course of many months, we were able to open some revenue facilities. We were able to generate some income. And then the state, because we were a state agency, the state finally came through with some operating revenue for us that allowed us to rebuild. And but I can tell you initially, it was a pretty daunting, it was very, very difficult. And my wife was a teacher in Jefferson Parish, and we had to live with another couple in Jefferson Parish for a number of months so she could go to work, because they were threatening to fire teachers if they didn't show up to work. So she had to go to work. And so therefore I was in my house and she was there.
Do you know of any other park that had a similar experience?
You know, there have been other parks where portions of the park have, you know, been flooded by a river that may have run through them, or a wildfire. Griffith Park in Los Angeles has had a number of wildfires through the years that have destroyed it. But it's a, you know, it's 4,000 acres. Most of it's, you know, rural. Most of it's, you know, not developed. I really don't know any other park as large as City Park in New Orleans that was basically totally annihilated and, you know, completely destroyed, and then had a kind of rebuild from scratch.
Without much money to do it with. And that's another amazing part of the story, the ability to raise funds for all of this. One thing that comes to my mind that I thought was kind of cool was that the when FEMA came to town, you all allowed FEMA to park its trailers. It was like a parking lot by the, what was the tennis court? And yeah. I said, well, this is a good idea. Let FEMA be right next door. So that was
There were a lot of strange things that happened there. You know, the 3rd District Police Station that served the park was destroyed. And so the police came to us and said, can we put our temporary trailers in the park? And well, sure. I mean, you know, we don't have any police presence here at all. So sure, you can put your trailers in the park. And one day in 2006 or so, I'm looking out the window and I see the police parading people in handcuffs past the only playground that we had. And I thought these were the administrative offices of the 3rd District. Said, oh no, this is where we bring people now when we arrest them for drugs or prostitution or whatever. I said, well, that really looks good in the park. I mean, I'm trying to rebuild this park, and you know, you're parading prisoners back mm-hmm. and forth. And then if you remember, there were hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of campers who showed up and camped out in the park. They were providing cleanup services, you know, to various areas of the park, in the whole city, in the region. And there were no hotels, obviously, open. So they just camped in the park. And
so this is a group of people that just naturally, the charity sort of thing that they go to.
Well, it's not a charity. I mean, there were some of that, certainly. Yeah. There were some charity that showed up with food to help, you know, feed people who were working. But these were contractors, debris contractors that go around the country and, you know, and offer their services and clean up after major disasters. And so they just camped out in the park. And because we had no money, we had no revenue at all. I told one of my staff who was still there, well, let's go and try to collect rent from these people. They're in the park and they're renting here. And otherwise they would be paying for a hotel, but they're not. And so I sent him out, and he came back after a day And he said, Bob, I need somebody to go with a weapon with me, because they think I'm here, you know, just trying to, you know, get their money. But after we went, you know, tent to tent, you know, most of them were happy to pay some kind of money just to be able to be there and, you know, and make the money that they were making. And once they knew the money was going to go to the park and, you know, not some other place, you know, they were pretty happy to pay a minimal rent.
Now, you all were very impressive in like gathering money, like from foundations and donations. Yeah, I think that was a good bit of the part of the success of getting it back running again.
Well, you know, certainly we were in a position where we, you know, we had a plan, but we had no money, you know, and we had no money to operate under. But we were able to use the plan and go to people who wanted to help. If you remember back then, Errol, for, you know, the first 5 years or so, there were many people who wanted to help the city and they wanted to help the park. And we were able to go to them and say, here's our plan. What parts of this plan would you be willing to underwrite that you could adopt? Do you want to help us reforest the park? You know, do you want us to replace street furniture? You know, do you want to do something with small children? Do you want playgrounds? And we were able to find a lot of people and a lot of corporations and foundations that were willing to come into the city. Sometimes they'd come with their and have a conference downtown, and then they'd give us a bunch of money to do things, and we would do things, and then they would all come out to the park and they would use their labor to clean up sections of the park. Having the plan was critical. It was just really critical to us to be able to use it as a fundraising tool.
And didn't you create like a volunteer section, a kind of with like a?
I did. It was interesting, you know. So we were there, 23 people, 1,300 acres, and people started to show up. You know, they would show up with rakes and shovels, and they would go, "Where do we go? You know, what do we do? How do we clean up?" And so the very first person I hired back, after having laid off 90% of them, the very first person was a volunteer coordinator who could meet people and say, this is where we need you today. This is where we need you tomorrow. And this is the, you know, we need you to bring your own wheelbarrow or your own lawnmower and help us get the park cleaned up. So volunteers were immensely important to the park's recovery.
Now, of course, one of the signature events in City Park is the annual celebration in the Oaks. If I recall, didn't you have like just a minimal or a few lights up, or did you have that first Christmas after Katrina?
Yeah, that first Christmas, we were determined to try to hold some kind of Christmas festival. First of all, to help us raise money, we needed money desperately, and second, there was virtually nothing else open in the city. You know, there was nothing here. There were people who had come back and were working on their house or their business, but there was no, celebratory functions being had in the city. No Christmas kind of lights. So, we were fortunate that many of our Christmas displays were on the second floor of a warehouse. The first floor of which flooded, but the second floor of which were dry. And we were able to, salvage some Christmas lights and decorations. And then we rented some amusement rides because ours were all damaged or destroyed. So we rented some amusement rides from a company in Slidell, and we threw up a temporary fence around it. And we opened for 19 days. And, It was very moving experience. If people came out, they were thrilled to pay, you know, whatever we charged for the few rides that we had and the Christmas lights that we had. But it was a very moving experience. And I remember shaking hands with many, many New Orleanians who were able to come through for the 19 days and thanked us for being able to put on an event, something they could bring their children to. I think all of my employees were very touched by that event.
I remember a big event always is like that gala at the beginning before it opens officially. And the gala is usually a big thing with all kind of food, rides, and drinks, everything. And I remember going to the gala. It was a lot different. First of all, there wasn't any food, okay? Okay. What there were was like a few tables with wines and stuff like that. And so it was basically drinking and walk around, and it was decorated minimally. But what I remember most about that is everybody was just so glad to be seeing each other. Yes. You know, nothing else mattered. And of course, everybody had Katrina stories to tell.
Right? Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And so that night was probably the gayest of all galas, just to be there with minimum provisions.
And, you know, that is an historic part of what, you know, City Park is a gathering place for people in this community to come together. And so even though we didn't have food and you brought your own booze, a lot of people brought their own booze and all that, it was touching because you could communicate back with people and you go, oh, you're staying, you're not leaving, you know, you're going to restore your house or your business or whatever. It was very a very moving event, as you describe it.
To this day, I mean, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I have a great respect for those New Orleanians who stayed, you know, who were there for that. And when somebody comes back after 12 years and says, hey, I'm back, you know, I say, well, you know, good to see you. But you know,
yeah. Yeah.
Where were you?
There's a part in the book, in my book, where I talk a little bit about the people who managed to come back, people like me who had a job, but they also had a damaged house that they, you know, would be working on. And, you know, I said, you know, when the going gets tough, you know, the tough really do get going and everyone else leaves. Yeah. So the people who stayed, they showed a lot of heart.
Yeah. When did you, how long was it before you could look back and say, you know, I think we're going to make this? I see the light at the end of the tunnel.
I mean, our biggest problem was operating revenue, right? I mean, because our operating services were all destroyed and heavily damaged. So trying to raise money to pay the salaries, even of the people that we had, was extremely difficult. And it wasn't until the state finally put us back, as they did a number of entities. If you remember, the state rescued a number of state entities that were wiped out and had no revenue. And the state finally put us back in the operating budget in like 06, 07, and 08 for various amounts of money to let us hire people back to rebuild, to, you know, fix things up, to get going again. And I think once the state put us in the operating budget for the first time in late 2006 for some money, I felt like they were not going to let this go. You know, they were not just going to say, well, that's too bad, you don't have any money, you know, the state's in difficult shape, you know, too bad, so sad. Once that happened, I felt like we could make it.
That's one thing that a lot of people might not understand, that despite the park being named City Park, it's really a state park, and that the city has never really provided a whole lot for it.
Well, historically, that's correct. The city hardly ever provided any money for the park. And as you know, it wasn't until 2019 when we were able to move the property tax for recreation agencies around and have a successful property tax election, that City Park got any money from the city for operating expenses.
I remember you're talking about the one when City Park was lumped together with Nord and Audubon Park and everything.
Yeah, yes.
I remember that. And I can tell you, that thing would not have passed had it not been for City Park. I mean, it was the city park that was the leader on that.
Yes.
That was the first money-raising proposition that passed since Katrina, and it was city park that made it pass.
I think so. You remember it came a couple of years after Audubon tried to pass a big millage and
it flopped. Yeah.
It's just terrible. It flopped. And then we put together Audubon and Nord and Parkway and City Park and said, let's try to redistribute some of the millage that Audubon had and didn't need anymore because it was paying off the bonds of the zoo and the aquarium. And we were able to put a group together and do a very good campaign. And I believe that property tax passed with 76% of the vote.
That's amazing. And that's a real tribute to the park. I'll tell anybody it was the park that made it pass. But didn't you get some also like things like the Urban Land Institute, or was that after?
Well, there were a lot of people that came later, you know, later on in the course of the redevelopment of the park and offered ideas and suggestions. And and truthfully, it was mainly the plan that we had adopted in 2005 that carried us.
Okay. You tell the story, and you mentioned in the book, that City Park was built, at least the funding of it, was built on tragedies. Like after the Great Depression and WPA.
Yeah, the major watershed events in the park, besides its, you know, creation, John McDonough, you know, donating some land to begin the park. The major watershed events in the park were the Great Depression and Hurricane Katrina. Because the park didn't, you know, was just a lot of land with little money, but the Great Depression came, needed to put a lot of people to work, the WPA, Civilian Conservation Corps, and the federal government invested over $12 million in the park. And back in the 1930s, $12 million was a whole lot of money to build roads and bridges and sewer systems and, you know, the basic infrastructure of the park. And then the next major influx of big money, federal money, was Hurricane Katrina. And although it started very slow, we only had $6,500 from FEMA for the first 6 months after we got back. Eventually, FEMA provided over $30 million to help rebuild the park. So those were two tremendous watershed events in the history of the park.
You know, the WPA contribution, I mean, not only did it build bridges and roads, but there was so much style and art to it, that whole Art Deco look that you drive around the park and see the bridges and see the design. These aren't ordinary bridges over there, okay? And of course, all the work with Enrique Alvarez, that was all part of that WPA money. So yeah. not only did it provide money, but it really provided an artistic look to the park.
It did, and even today, I'm amazed at the quality of the construction that was done. I mean, it is really unbelievable how much concrete was put in the Tad Gormley Stadium, or how sturdily the bridges were built, and even the infrastructure. All these years later, you know, the park still has water lines that were put in by the WPA.
That's the amazing thing. I mean, people look at the park and they say, oh, a beautiful patch of green. But they don't know it's under the ground, okay?
Right.
All the very sophisticated lines they'll put in to funnel water from one spot to the other. I mean, it's really brilliant.
It is. They had brilliant engineers back in the WPA days that did a great job. And in general, the park has always had really quality engineers and architects to do its work.
Yeah. What today are some of your favorite things in the park? Do you ever go there just as a normal citizen, as Bob Becker, former superintendent? We probably can't do that emotionally.
I like to play golf. So I really like the golf clubhouse and the two golf courses that we were able to build in the back of the park. And it's amazing to me today, Errol, how many people don't even know there is a back of the park. I mean, there are many people in New Orleans who never have gone to the back of the park. I mean, I still run into people who just get, where? What are you talking about? But so I like the golf course. I love the dog park. I was so happy we were able to build the dog park with the help of a lot of citizens. I look forward to taking my new dog to the dog park soon. I loved when we had our wildflower program and we put wildflowers through the park and you were able to come down and see people enjoy the color and the vibrancy of that. That was always a favorite of mine.
I know that was your idea too. I know you were talking about it. Let's get this little patch of land and put wildflowers. What are you crazy? I mean, putting wildflowers. But man, once those wildflowers started growing and blooming, I mean, people were crazy about it.
It's often interesting to me that some of the things that the people like best of all the improvements that we did were the wildflowers, the wildflower program, and then the bollards that we put in to help protect the trees from cars, you know, rolling over their roots and all that. Some of the things that cost the least but made the biggest impact.
Trying to think of the things that are my favorite, but it's just too many things to mention. So the book, it's been out a couple of months now, and I guess it's at all places where people buy good books, right?
I think so. I think it's in many stores. It's certainly in the park. It's in the park's gift store. It's on Amazon. It's in Barnes & Noble. I'll be making appearances at, you know, various bookstores in the month of November. And as I said, this coming Saturday, not this next Saturday, the 4th, but the 11th, the park is having an event in the Pavilion of the Two Sisters for people who are interested in purchasing a book and having me sign it. And then because the book is a coffee table book, really, it's a beautifully done book. And there's obviously the great stories of the park and the park's recovery and, you know, the Confederate monument controversy and COVID and, you know, the things that we had to overcome. But it has beautiful pictures in it. And it's really a coffee table book. And I've been surprised the number of people who have bought books to give as Christmas presents. It's gratifying to see that happen.
And it's a great, I mean, it has great art, great photography in it, but it's a good primer for people who just want to study about dealing with crises and the kind of things you have to go through. I mean, not everything is applicable, but it just kind of tells you something about the attitude that you have to have and kind of like the general approach for it. I mean, you can probably go and do lectures around the country about dealing with a crisis now.
Yeah, maybe so. I certainly hope that some university professors pick it up for those people, universities that have courses in disaster management, disaster recovery, park planning. I hope they're able to pick up and use the book for that, because there are many, many lessons in the book about what to do when you're confronted with unimaginable tragedy. And how to pull it together and how to recover and how people can help you recover. I wrote it to tell the story of the last 20 years or so of the park, but it's maybe the only book that I'm aware of that talks about in detail a long-term history, 20-year history of you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and finding ways to, you know, make lemonade out of lemons. Mm-hmm. So I think it'd be very popular, and I hope it is.
Well, I'm sure it will be. Are there still coyotes running around the park?
You know, I have seen the remnants of coyotes on the golf course. Coyotes are an urban animal. You know, they're very hard to keep out. But when you have a place as big as the park, you know, coyotes tend to be able to find places where they can breed. And, you know, it's up to park management to decide, you know, how much they can tolerate a coyote presence in the park.
Yeah. Do you ever have any conversation with the people at Central Park?
I've not had any kind. I mean, Central Park brought staff down for several years after the hurricane, and we met with them and talked with them. But I have not had any conversations. I believe the new CEO of the park has a relationship with Central Park and probably keeps up a dialogue with them.
Yeah, you have the name, but that's because it's in New York, though. I mean, but the city park that really deserves a lot of the respect. After you, Bob, thanks a lot for. One, what you did with the park and now doing this book, that so those stories can live on.
Well, thank you, Errol. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. How's your golf game?
Not good, but, you know, not good. I don't know, Errol, if many people understand that your father was integral to the success of the park and was the longest serving park manager in the park's history. So your relationship to the park runs far deeper than just being a visitor.
Yeah, well, that's a full disclosure thing. Yeah, he was there for a long time. They didn't have things like friends organizations back then, you know, and so it was a different world, but certainly you carried it to another dimension. So thank you very much. Everybody who's listening, look for the book. And if you're out of town, go to, to Amazon, and you can order it. It's really worth it. Okay?
Thanks, Errol. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.